this is Pod Save the UK. I'm Coco Khan.
I'm Nish Kumar, and Coco, you are back.
I'm back. Brr, 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 brr. Don't call it a comeback, because also I'm just still in my flat, so it's not really quite. I'm sleep deprived. I've hardly followed any politics for the last month, to be completely honest. But if I had to guess what's been happening, I'd say it's probably not that dissimilar to what was happening before I left. So the Tories are in shambles. Labour is becoming the Tories in how they're turning right. And everyone is running scared of Nigel Farage.
That sums it up, yeah. On the show today, we'll talk about Labour's rightward moves with their immigration white paper. And we'll be chatting with Minnie Ryman, CEO of the charity campaigning on migrant rights, Praxis.
Plus, I hear there's some trade deals afoot. Is this a win for Keir Starmer?
It's complicated. We'll also have an update on the Green Party's leadership race, and we'll be asking, should we be looking beyond our regular political choices? So, Coco, how have you been? I want to know, the listeners want to know, everybody wants to know.
Well, I mean, you know, having a baby for the first time is a very emotional experience. There's been enormous highs, some of the greatest highs of my life and some of the greatest lows of my life, often just 10 minutes in between them. So it really is, you just sort of mainlining life. Everything's very raw and very heightened. But, you know, it's good. I'm very sleep deprived. I hallucinate now. That's from sleep deprivation. That's what
Coco,
I do.
I will say that motherhood doesn't seem to have changed you. I have had several conversations with you in the past where I ask you what you've been up to and you say there's been a lot of highs and a lot of lows and
right.
There are occasional hallucinations.
In a way, it's just a sort of natural progression, really. Who needs acid when you can have a baby? I mean, it really is opening doors of perception. I had this moment the other day. I hope this is not a violation of my son's privacy, but he had terrible trapped wind for about sort of 48 to 72 hours. I was crying constantly. And then the poo comes, the giant poo. Oh, hallelujah, the poo. And so we sort of settle him down. And then I go out into the back garden. It's been beautiful sunshine here in London. But I hadn't seen any of it because I've just been in the four walls of my home. And I just opened the door and felt the sun on my face. And all I could think about was Shawshank Redemption. Just that bit where Tim Robbins' character comes out of the sewers and he's pulling at his shirt and there's rain on his face and it's so elated. I just had that Morgan Freeman voice, you know, Coco walked through the shit and the piss.
Yeah, exactly. You were walking through miles of shit and piss.
Yeah, it was, you know, in a way, that high justifies so many of the lows.
So you're doing okay, even though you just compared the process of having a child to the most famous film about prison.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that tracks, actually. I think that really tracks. I apologise in advance because I'm really out of the loop with politics. I mean, you should see my YouTube algorithm. It's just like how to fart a baby, how to wind a baby. Just, I feel there is probably some kind of opportunity for us in Pod Save the UK to combine these two things. One of my mates, I mentioned this in passing to about like, oh, you know, I don't know anything about politics. Everything's been about my baby's nappy regime. And she said, well, that's actually quite convenient because all you need to know about this week is that Keir Starmer's shat his pants.
Yes, it's... so look, let's try and bring you up to date on what you've missed. The Prime Minister has had quite the week. First of all, and perhaps strangest, and let's just get through this so we've said it and then we can move on. He became the centre of a wild Russian-backed conspiracy theory that he was taking cocaine with Emmanuel Macron and Friedrich Merz whilst on a train travelling to Kyiv.
They call him Keir Starmer. That's what they call him. No one believed that, though, did they?
So there was a photograph and it looked like there was a white powder on the table. People were saying on the internet that it was a bag. It's not a bag, it's just a tissue. But the internet remains absolutely unconvinced. So after being the centre of that nightmarish conspiracy theory, he was then at the centre of a string of events that absolutely nobody wants to see. Two properties owned by Starmer caught fire, including his family home in North London, after they were targeted by a series of arson attacks.
Wow. I wasn't really expecting that story to end up there.
But look, in more normal political news, there was a speech announcing the government's immigration plans that Starmer made this week at the announcement of the white paper. And here's what I would say. If you are planning on making a speech about immigration in the United Kingdom, what I would do is I would look at the text and just before I hit print, I would quickly Google Enoch Powell, Rivers of Blood, and just have a quick, you know, control F just to make sure that there are no phrases that overlap with one of the most infamously racist speeches in British political history. However, either Keir Starmer or someone at his office failed to hit Control F. Let's have a quick listen to it now.
Nations depend on rules, fair rules. Sometimes they're written down, often they're not. But either way, they give shape to our values, guide us towards our rights, of course, but also our responsibilities, the obligations we owe to each other. Now, in a diverse nation like ours, and I celebrate that, these rules become even more important. Without them, we risk becoming an island of strangers, not a nation that walks forward together.
Just in case there are people unfamiliar, The Rivers of Blood is a speech that was made by Enoch Powell, a Conservative politician, in Birmingham on the 20th of April, 1968. It's become this kind of totemic moment in public expressions of British anti-immigrant sentiment. And the essence of the speech is that a multicultural society which allowed immigration would essentially collapse social cohesion. Given what Starmer said yesterday, it's probably worth specifically quoting that speech. And this is what Powell said: for reasons which they could not comprehend and in pursuance of a decision by default on which they were never consulted, they found themselves made strangers in their own country. They found their wives unable to obtain hospital beds in childbirth, their children unable to obtain school places, their homes and neighbourhoods changed beyond recognition. Now, it's worth pointing out that Keir Starmer and various people around the Prime Minister have denied that there are any link between the two speeches. But I'm sorry to say, we've all got eyes and have the power of literacy. Given that what Starmer is saying is essentially along the same lines as Powell, in that mass immigration has collapsed social cohesion in the United Kingdom, given the use of the island of strangers line, the rest of us can be forgiven for making the direct comparison. Among the critics was suspended Labour MP Zara Sultana, who wrote on social media, "That speech fueled decades of racism and division. Echoing it today is a disgrace. It adds to anti-migrant rhetoric that puts lives at risk." The accusation was put to Home Secretary Yvette Cooper on Radio 4's Today programme on Tuesday.
I don't think it's right to make those comparisons. It's completely different. And the Prime Minister said yesterday, I think almost in the same breath, talked about the diverse country that we are and that being part of our strength.
I'm but not it's saying also it is Enoch time, Powell. No, I'm saying, did he know? Yeah, did his speechwriters know? Did you know that he was echoing Enoch Powell?
I don't know. I didn't,
and are you
I
uncomfortable with it? Is it unnerving? John McDonnell said to you in the Commons yesterday, it was shockingly divisive. Words matter. Language matters.
No, I think we do actually have to be able to have a serious conversation about the policies.
My goodness, that's chilling stuff, that, isn't it? So I was listening to the news agents and Lord Dubs, who's been a former guest on this show, I mean, he was quite upfront about it. I suppose given his own story coming over on the Kinder transport, I think we should listen to him when he says he recognises the sounds and the smell of encroaching fascism. He said it himself. Yes, it is reminiscent of Enoch Powell.
The journalist and historian Taj Ali pointed out on X that there were indeed rivers of blood after Enoch Powell made his speech. Racist violence doesn't occur in a vacuum. It is enabled by rhetoric from the top. Starmer was very clear that this was a policy announcement and wasn't reactive politics. But coming so soon after Reform made such notable gains in the by-election, it's hard to not see this as an act of reactive political cowardice and an attempt to head off Nigel Farage. But I just also want to raise the issue of the riots that happened last summer on the 4th and 5th of August. Full-blown race riots happened in this country. Now, the very fact that the Prime Minister, and I don't care if it's a Labour Prime Minister or a Conservative Prime Minister, I'm past caring at this point. The very fact that less than a year from those riots, when for a period of time in this country, people of colour lived in fear of their lives and feared for their safety, the very fact that the Prime Minister is now pointing the finger at immigration and mass immigration as the reason for a disruption in social cohesion is morally abhorrent. A lot of us in this country last summer felt like strangers in our own home. there were a huge number of us that felt suddenly a violent disconnect with the place in which we were born or the place that we had lived for most of our lives. And this speech, from my perspective, felt like Starmer was offering the hand of friendship to the rioters last summer. I'm sure that there will be people that would disagree with me on that. But as a person of colour that was born in this country and considers it my home, Starmer's words make me feel like a stranger in my own back garden. And that is not something that I expect from any British politician in 2025. The rhetoric was so reminiscent of Powell, and it has left me with a kind of genuine feeling of disquiet. And my sense of the speech is that it was attempting to placate racists. And I'm sure people will have views on it. I'm sure people will have views on my views, and that's fine. But I just wanted to articulate the way that that speech made me feel personally. Beyond the rhetoric, let's actually talk about what's in the white paper. So it's a hefty package of policies that promises to cut net migration by not only curbing irregular migration, but by tightening legal routes into the UK too. It's been described as the most radical shift in the immigration policy of this country since we left the European Union, and it could be decisive at the next election.
So the plan includes stricter English language requirements, cuts to legal migration routes, including scrapping visas for overseas care workers, as well as stricter rules for international students and raising the qualification threshold for the skilled worker route. It will also make it harder for people living and working in the UK to secure permanent settlement. It doubles the length of time most people need to wait before applying, from 5 years to 10.
But will this address labour shortages in the NHS or the care service? Jeremy Corbyn, the former Labour leader, put this very question to the House of Commons on Monday.
There's been no speaking up about the enormous value of migration to this country that's kept our NHS running, our education service running, and so much more, and that there are already 130,000 vacancies in the care sector. Does anything in her white paper do anything to improve community relations or deal with the now labour shortage within the NHS and the care service? Or is it all about trying to please these people who unfortunately sit in front of me?
For clarity, for those listening to the podcast, these people that Corbyn is referring to are Nigel Farage and his Reform cronies, who are sat in the clip directly in front of Corbyn, grinning like Cheshire cats. Now, look, I don't know how many times we can keep repeating the same phrase. The lesson of British politics in the last 15 years particularly is that you cannot out-Farage Nigel Farage. All you do is you give his perspectives credibility. David Cameron comes to office on a wave of promises to stop the Conservative Party's obsession with the European Union. He dismisses Eurosceptics on the right of the British political spectrum as being a basket of loonies, fruitcakes, and closet racists. Then, over the course of the 2010 to 15 Parliament, he finds himself in a political tight spot. He then promises a referendum on the European Union to placate Nigel Farage. He then loses that referendum and it costs him his political career. Since then, successive Conservatives have attempted to placate Nigel Farage by heading him off either with policy or with rhetoric. It has not worked. There is no reason to believe that it is going to work for Keir Starmer. Nigel Farage himself told Newsnight's Nick Watt that Starmer's language was a catastrophic mistake that will split the left in two. Maybe if you're willing to listen to Nigel Farage on certain issues, listen to him on this fucking issue. Labour MPs are up in arms about this, especially when combined with welfare reforms and winter fuel payment cuts. Coco, what will this do to the Labour Party?
I mean, there's lots of problematic Labour MPs, sure, but I would, if I was giving many of them the benefit of the doubt, I expect they join the Labour Party because they think it is a party for progress. And they probably have some sense that, you know, migration and diversity is good. I can't imagine many of them are very comfortable with this. And I just want to come back to something that Yvette Cooper said, because it's really rankled me and it's going around in my head when she talked about, like, oh, we have to have a grown-up conversation about this. I really deplore that line that is trotted out when anyone says anything racist. If you want to have a grown-up conversation about migration, okay, let's have it then, mate. Let's have a conversation about climate change, which is displacing loads of migrants. Let's have a conversation about bad wars that we don't need to be involved in, that is also displacing loads of migrants. Let's have a conversation about the failed privatization project that has plunged loads of ordinary people into poverty. And let's have a conversation about neoliberal capitalism and how it's individualized everyone so that we no longer have a sense of community. Come on then, if you think you're hard enough, let's have a grown-up conversation. But they won't do it. They'll just do the same line over and over again. Anyway, it's really infuriates me. And I'm sure I'm certainly not the only person in the left, and I'm sure there's Labour MPs in that group who would feel the same. I would not be surprised if this is the final straw. I mean, it's, you know, after winter fuel payments, child benefits, it's a lot. Who is this party? I expect a lot of MPs might be asking, did I sign up for this?
Well, look, after the break, we are going to attempt to have that grown-up conversation about immigration and try and separate some of the rhetoric from the policy.
PodSave the UK is brought to you by Shopify.
Shopify can be a catalyst for turning a dream into a reality. If you want to start a business, like, for example, a podcast, hey, please don't start a podcast. We don't need more of those in the space, okay? I don't need more competition. If you want to start a business that is anything other than a podcast, you will have a lot of concerns about how to turn that dream into a reality. And the best thing to do is to use Shopify to help make your dreams happen.
Shopify is the commerce platform behind millions of businesses around the world and 10% of all e-commerce in the US, from household names to brands just getting started.
What if you can't design a website? Shopify's got you from the get-go with beautiful, ready-to-go templates to match your brand style.
What if I need a hand? Get help with everyday tasks like enhancing product images, writing product descriptions, or generating discount codes with Shopify's AI tools created for commerce.
What if people haven't heard about my brand? Shopify helps you find your customers with easy-to-run email and social media campaigns.
And what if I get stuck? Well, Shopify is always around to share advice with their award-winning 24/7 customer support.
Turn those dreams into and give them the best shot at success with Shopify.
Sign up for your $1 per month trial and start selling today at shopify.co.uk/podsavetheuk.
Go to shopify.co.uk/podsavetheuk.
Shopify.co.uk/podsavetheuk.
So, the rhetoric around the immigration white paper is harsh. Nigel Farage is jumping for joy. But the rightward lurch hasn't been well received by unions and sector leaders. Rosalind Gill, head of policy at the National Centre for Universities and Businesses, warned that the crackdown on international students will jeopardise the sustainability and global connectivity of UK universities.
And in response to the scrapping of the overseas care worker visa, Professor Martin Green, the CEO of Care England, has said international recruitment wasn't a silver bullet, but it was a lifeline. Taking it away now with no warning, no funding and no alternative is not just short-sighted, it's cruel.
So there certainly is a lot to unpack. To help take us through the government's plans is Minnie Rahman. Minnie is the CEO of Praxis, an organisation that campaigns to end the hostile environment for migrants and is the largest provider of free immigration advice in London. Minnie, welcome to PodSave the UK.
Hi, guys. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, I wish we were having you in slightly cheerier circumstances, but I guess your job title precludes cheerier circumstances.
Yeah, it's not been nice for the last however many years I've worked in this sector.
So what do you make as a kind of first reaction to the government's plans?
It's a difficult one because in some instances, the bark of this paper is in some ways worse than the bite. And there's a lot of bits of different detail in there, which is quite conflicting and difficult to untangle. For us as an organisation, there's a few bits in there which we're really worried about. The first bit obviously being the kind of rhetoric that's used. How is that going to impact migrant communities? What is this going to do for racial discrimination in the country? Who is going to be looked at as a kind of stranger or a target, someone to treat in isolation and someone who doesn't belong as part of our communities? And then we have the very real policy changes in there, some of which, as you alluded to, refer to kind of care workers and students. But there's also quite a significant bit in the paper which which talks about people's right to settle in the UK and to become citizens. And ultimately, that's the bit that I think is really going to affect the kind of people that Praxis sees every day, and also just for people who've been in the country for quite a long period of time already.
What are those changes?
So what the government is essentially proposing is to make it harder for you to get something called indefinite leave to remain. So that's your permanent status in the UK. So there's lots of different routes to settlement, one of which was the 5-year route, which, you know, a lot of people on work visas are on and a lot of different kind of people are on. And they're going to scrap that route and make it a 10-year route. So what that means is every 2.5 years for 10 years, you're going to have to pay thousands and thousands of pounds to stay here. And then at the end of that 10 years, you'll get the opportunity to become a sort of permanent citizen. And what we see in Praxis is that along that journey, they're pushed into a cycle of debt, destitution, and even poverty because they're paying these extortionate fees and because they're not allowed access to the public safety net through something called no recourse to public funds. So the government is now proposing putting a lot more people on that route, which means we're just basically telling people that you can come here, we'll exploit you, we'll use you for your work, your labour, maybe even your kind of cultural contributions, but we're not going to let you stay and we're going to punish you along the way for wanting to be here. So for us, that's a kind of really concerning actual policy choice, but it's also concerning in terms of the narrative and what we're telling people who want to make their lives here.
So the government plans to introduce a contributions-based system. So it's this idea that, you know, you're explaining there that immigrants need to earn their Britishness. You know, they're inherently strangers and then they need to earn their Britishness. And at the minute they've put on this timeline of 10 years, but there is always a question, which is, you know, how long does that actually go on for? Am I a stranger because of the colour of my skin? I mean, do you think it's fair to say that this rhetoric is dangerous and will impact not just migrants, but just people of colour, people from different backgrounds who are British?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, we've always seen a kind of weird combination of rhetoric and policy. So the hostile environment, which Praxis campaigns on and which has been in place since 2012, the language around that was, let's make the UK a really hostile place for migrants so they don't come here. But then it introduced some actual policies which really have put racial discrimination into our public services and into the way the country works. So, for example, you have something called right to rent, which is that you have to show a visa before you can rent a house. Landlords themselves say, well, actually, if we have a list of people, which is like John Smith and Minnie Rahman, we're more likely to take John Smith because, you know, we don't want to carry out this check and we don't want to get it wrong. So landlords themselves say, the Resident Landlords Association did a piece of work on this a few years ago, saying that we're implementing racial discrimination because of this set of policies. And I think the track of having both a horrible narrative and policies which put that kind of discrimination into the country means that we're in the position that we're in now, where reform is on the rise, where riots are happening across the country, where these things are relatively uncontrolled. And for some reason, the government thinks that the best idea is to keep pursuing that narrative instead of doing something different.
The overarching aim of the white paper is to cut net migration, which according to the ONS has quadrupled since pre-pandemic levels. Taking all of our opinions out of this for the moment, will the measures in the white paper actually work?
I mean, there's nothing progressive or achievable about this, to be honest. I'm not an economist, which makes it even weirder that I seem to know this information and the government doesn't. But really the question you want to answer is, why are people out of work in the UK? Why is there no jobs in the UK? What impact is net migration having? And I think it's a really disingenuous kind of simplification of the issues in the country to claim that reducing net migration is going to have a positive impact in any way on the issues we're seeing in the country. So look, of course, if you cut people's visas, less people are going to come into the UK. If you make it more difficult to get into the UK, that is going to happen. But that is not going to be good for the economy. So you can't kind of treat it in isolation. And the reason why people are out of work, or the reason why we're having a high level of unemployment, is for numerous reasons. You know, we've had some huge economic shocks to the country: COVID, Brexit, rising energy prices, all of which disrupt spending, consumer flows, affect businesses. There's also a lack of investment, like regional inequality exists. And then on top of that, people are not working because there's a lack of childcare support, or there's long-term sickness through mental health, or there's a lack of skills training. None of that, none of reducing net migration, is going to create a situation in where we resolve that. So saying that, you know, we'll reduce net migration and everything is going to improve is just false and really quite disingenuous, because that's just not how the economy works.
But that, it's really important that we dig into this. You know, as Starmer sort of tries to hold together a kind of electoral coalition in a single speech around immigration, the red meat that he's offered one side is Island of Strangers. Oh, I'm so sorry, I didn't realise this sounded exactly like Enoch Powell. I didn't mean Rivers of Blood, I meant Streams of Plasma. Whatever that half of this thing is. The other half of it is he's trying to simultaneously make the progressive case that mass migration has led to a kind of exploitation of cheap immigrant labour as a way of undercutting British workers. Mass migration is an expression of free market capitalism. Where do you stand on this argument? Because it's really important, because this is the case that Labour is making to its core voters.
It's a scapegoating. It's a way of being able to tell a story to the country about why everything is currently failing. And, you know, I don't want to kind of deny the fact that the country is not in a good place, right? We have poor housing, the NHS is struggling, the care system is struggling. The cost of living crisis is going up, and people are really feeling that on the ground. And I think this kind of, you know, migrants stealing jobs from British workers is just a way to tell a story to the public, which takes responsibility away from the government from actually having to kind of resolve these issues. Now, the problem is that when we get to the next election in a few years' time, or whenever it might be, and this hasn't improved the situation for people on the ground, because it won't. People won't see migration reducing and a positive impact on the country. What will happen at the next election? And the only option is for people to kind of go further towards the right and further towards reform, because reform is saying they'll achieve everything Labour can't with the same narrative. They're basically finding a way to make that narrative acceptable. And I think what's really difficult for progressives is for us to kind of make this argument in a positive way, that actually migrants are really beneficial to the economy, but they're also just fine as people. There's no problem with migrants being in the UK. There's no problem with black and brown people being in the UK. We've had a positive impact on British society. And also, we've got historical colonial relationships with the UK, and we have to accept that. So for me, I think the problem is, how do we win this argument without playing on the same terms as Labour and the right at the moment?
Starmer has said that we're charging employers more to recruit from overseas, and if they do, they must prove that they're investing in British workers and increasing British skills. If you kind of create a gap in a sector that's already on its knees, and that applies both to the social care sector and also the university sector, you know, they have had a lifeline from kind of international students coming. Is the problem partly here that they're introducing this with no supplementary policy that addresses how we fill that gap? And does that mean it could be detrimental to the government's growth agenda?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, where are the strategies that match the impact of these kind of policies? If you listen to Yvette Cooper's statement in the House of Commons on the white paper, she basically was saying, oh, you know, we'll do a consultation later on, we'll think about this bit later on, don't worry, you know, we've got it under control, trust us. But here's just a really set of nasty policies in the first instance. And they don't have a long-term plan for how they're going to fix these things. And this is exactly what I was saying earlier, that you know, when the situation is ultimately worse in a few years' time, because these issues haven't been resolved effectively and there's no comprehensive strategy, and this rhetoric's gone up tenfold, what kind of country are we going to be in 4 years' time, where we're in a worse position and there's a very, very clear scapegoat coming from several political parties? That is really, really dangerous for everyone, and quite concerning. And this strategy has been tried for nearly 15 years now. And the one thing that I think is really important in this whole story is that actually the voices of people in the care sector are missing. The voices of migrants who are carrying out domestic work are missing. The voices of students who've done their study here and then been cut out through the visa system are missing. And we never hear from those people because we're so busy hearing from the right and from reform. And I'd really like to see some of those voices out there.
Minnie, beneath some of the inflammatory rhetoric, is there any actual nuance here? Because the white paper does briefly address the issue of exploitation caused by employees' visas being tied to unscrupulous sponsors. And it also indicates that they will explore making it easier for workers to move between licensed sponsors. So are these actual useful positives that we can sort of dredge out of this shipwreck?
Yeah, there are actually a few very small crumbs in there. So there's, as you said, the suggestions that they will make it easier for workers to change sponsors, which is a major driver of exploitation. That's a very welcome thing. There's also the introduction of a new route to settlement for parents whose children have died. And there's also some suggestion about financial barriers to young adults who've lived here most of their lives and us barred from citizenship. So there's kind of a few tiny, very small wins in there, and they will have a big impact on the people that they affect. But ultimately, against the wider backdrop of the paper, it's so minor. And actually, these, you know, there's lots of other little things like that that they could have done, which aren't in the paper. And that's coming from a sort of policy nerd who's like, well, why did they choose that over this? But yeah, it just doesn't really have a meaningful impact on the big picture. But, you know, I don't want to detract that those are good things that are very welcome.
So, Minnie, I just want to play you a clip from, and I can't believe I'm saying this, Kemi Badenoch's Twitter.
We need to make the wider case on immigration. We welcome migrants.
People
should immigration
to live...
be reduced?
Well, I don't believe in numbers and I don't believe in salary gaps.
We've always welcomed people to work in this country. We could get a more positive route, which didn't take us into the place of, you know, numbers or quotas or, you know, you're only worth having it, you can earn a certain amount of money.
What about foreign nationals living in the UK? Should they get a vote?
I would like us to look at that.
The Labour Party's been a bit scared of making the positive case for immigration for quite a number of years. I think we need to turn that round. The whole United Kingdom is better because of immigration.
Just for clarity, that was Keir Starmer there, making an argument for a more humane and progressive conversation on immigration. So, you know, I think it's hard to say which Keir Starmer was the real Keir Starmer. Is it that guy that we heard in the clip, or is it this guy that we're hearing now doing speeches reminiscent of Enoch Powell? But putting that aside, Minnie, how can we get back to that narrative about the positive case for immigration?
I feel really, really sad watching that clip. And I think it is really hard to tell whether that's something that Keir Starmer believes in or whether he's just so scared about winning the next election that he just is saying everything that Reform wants him to say. Look, I think the only thing that we can really do is try and bring a sort of basic level of honesty about what migration brings to our country to the conversation. You know, that is what has been missing. I would like to see more people with kind of lived experience of migration and people who are black and brown really being looked at as valuable stakeholders and voters and groups that should be thought about. And really, you know, migration has to be treated as part of the story and not the whole story. And actually, I would say that people need to start just kind of doing stuff in their local communities to stand up for each other and kind of say that this isn't how our communities work. We're not doing this alone. We are all part of the same community, whether you're migrant or not. And I think it's that kind of ground level work that we need to do to actually battle the kind of wins that Reform are having. It's really difficult, though, because the narrative is so wholly placed with where Reform are sitting that it feels like banging your head against a brick wall. But I think it will have an impact if we keep trying.
Well, Minnie, we are grateful to you for continuing to bang your head against said brick wall.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us on Pod Save the UK, Minnie Roman.
Thank you for having me.
Now, after the break, we take a look into the UK-US nothing burger of a trade deal and ask, should we be looking to new horizons for the next generation of politicians?
Now, Coco, with the immigration white paper story out of the way, we thought we'd catch you up on some of the other goings-on in the world, and specifically the world of UK politics. So last week, the government signed a trade deal with the US, and they were absolutely leaping for joy.
Okay, all right. Catch me up.
Nothing stirs the blood more than a trade deal. Number 10 called it a landmark economic deal that saves thousands of jobs. So on Friday morning, I was poised to create a piece of content. But James, the producer, and I were on the WhatsApp group discussing right. whether we should do like a reaction video to the UK-US trade deal. And I started trying to write some notes, and there was nothing to talk about because there's still so little detail. On what the trade deal actually involves. And so it was very difficult to make a comment on anything. There's no actual clarity on what the hell is going on.
Well, I mean, I've got some of the headlines in front of me, and they do make for amusing reading. So from the BBC, UK-US trade deal, platform for going further. A platform for going further. Okay, that sounds important. And then from Sky, UK-US trade deal isn't worth the paper it's written on. I kind of like that one because it's just a bit more straightforward. And in The Guardian, Britain hasn't agreed a trade deal with the US. It's ended a hostage negotiation.
Look, it's a win in a sense that we're the first country to secure a deal with Trump. And it's a win in the sense that we don't have 130% tariff like China did until this week. But let's be real, this isn't a free trade deal. And it's a downgrade that's being portrayed as an upgrade. The government has said that it won't back down on the digital services tax on companies like Facebook, Amazon and Meta. There is an agreement that suggests we won't be accepting chlorinated chicken, which is, again, not actually something that we have in writing, but it's something that hasn't been committed to yet. The actual detail, though, is in steel and cars. So there had been an import tax on cars of 25%. This has been cut to 10% for a maximum of 100,000 UK cars, which matches the number of cars that we exported to the US last year. The 25% tariff on steel and aluminium imports into the US that came into effect in March has been scrapped, which is obviously very, very good news for British Steel, which has just been brought under government control as it struggled to stay operational. The problem is that, especially in terms of the 10% car tariffs, it's a win in the context of everything that's happened since March, but it's still a downgrade from where we were 6 months ago. So 6 months ago, our tariff was 2.5%. Now it's 10%. And we're being told that that's something we should accept as a huge win for the country. We're being asked to accept defeat as victory in a lot of ways in terms of our trading relationships. Other positives include the NHS being completely off the cards for now. There's no formal inclusion of carve-outs for the pharmaceutical industry or the film industry on future tariffs either, though both sides agreed to negotiate further on both. This is in reference to a story that happened a couple of weeks ago where Trump proposed a 100% tariff on films produced outside of the US, which, given the size of our film industry and the fact that a lot of Hollywood films are choosing to film here, would be a huge, huge blow to the United Kingdom. Trump advisor Peter Navarro has also said that the UK's digital service tax is still in negotiations and is a very big deal to President Trump. Yeah, I'm fucking sure it's a big deal to President Trump. We saw the front row at his inauguration of Zuckerberg, Tim Cook, Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk. I'm sure the digital service tax is something that he's getting a lot of pressure on from some of his biggest benefactors. There's still a lot of detail missing from our trade agreement. And some of the details that we have are measurably a downgrade from the circumstances we found ourselves in 6 months ago. So it's very difficult to walk away from this and be told that we've won anything.
It could have been worse is the slogan of the Labour Party at the moment. I feel like that's really what they're asking us to buy into. It's just, okay, well, it could have been worse with the Tories. Well, it could have been worse with Trump. And yeah, I hear you on this. It sounds like it's a lot of hot air. I guess maybe we should have given Donald Trump a plane. Don't know if you saw that story. Did you see that story about how the Qataris have gifted Trump basically a flying palace to replace Air Force One, which he's saying is like, you know, totally cool thing to happen. I mean, I was speechless about it, but maybe that's what we should have done. Should have got him a flying Buckingham Palace, a flying Morley's, really, in spirit of the coronated chicken win.
Yes, I don't know how wide Amelia de Moldenberg is looking to expand her booking policy. And if Donald Trump is planning on being his her next chicken shop date, but I think this is right. He gets to keep the plane after his term in office ends, which is obviously, you know, it goes back to one of the oldest sayings in the book. It's not corruption when white people are involved. When white people are involved, it's a sensible grown-up trading relationship. If both sides of this equation had been East Asian or black or brown people, let me tell you, it would have been outright corruption. It would have been a disgrace. These third world people don't know how to run their countries. This is disgusting. Oh, there's a white guy involved. Guys, this is sensible, grown-up international relations between countries. And actually, you guys need to end your kind of student politics era of the president of the America should not just accept random planes from dodgy oil states.
It's like the word bribe has fallen out of the dictionary, hasn't it? It's
you now can't like bribe a white word. Person. You can just proportionately reward them for goods or services rendered. Another update on a story that we were talking about last week while you were away, Coco, is the Green Party leadership. We heard that Zach Polanski would challenge for it. Shortly after we published the pod, we heard that Carla Denyer, former guest of the show and co-leader with Adrian Ramsey, had decided not to recontest the leadership and was choosing to focus instead on her role as a new MP. Replacing her alongside Ramsey is Ellie Chowns, a longtime Green councillor and a former MEP. Obviously, feel strange to remind listeners of this, but MEP stands for Member of the European Parliament, which obviously is something that we no longer have cause for.
Yeah, those were the days. It's set up to be an interesting contest. I was surprised to see the co-leadership proposition continue. I mean, it's really becoming their USP. I mean, in a way, maybe it's quite cool. We have a co-leadership vibe.
Yeah.
I'm very much the Adrian Ramsey to your Carla Denyer in that nobody knows who the fuck I am. But, you know, still I persist. There are other political aspirants on the scene, though. So here's a clip of the BBC's Laura Koonsberg asking Gen Z musical icon and outspoken progressive young blood if he'd consider entering politics.
You know what? I have actually thought about that. I know it's crazy.
Not
I just,
crazy.
I feel like you start something as a musician and then you kind of connect with people on a daily basis. Like I always make an effort to see people outside the gigs and see people walk around a festival. And this whole community was built on human connection about how people live and how what people struggle with. And I thought maybe one day I think I could do something that would be... I could provide some good somewhere. So yeah, I think that has actually crossed my mind. Youngblood the politician. Wow. Don't know how that'd stand up.
You described his music in an incredible way to me the other day, Coco. You called him emo, but in a new way.
Why are you trying to publicly shame me?
I'm not trying to publicly shame you. I actually thought it was a pretty decent descriptor.
I thought that is the case. I'm not familiar with his entire oeuvre, but as I understand it, you know, he's a really cool young artist. But sometimes I look at things from the youth and I think, get your own culture, mate. So I see young blood and I understand that he is a new emo and I'm here for it.
Were you an emo? Is that why you're so defensive about this?
I would not classify it as defensive. I was emo adjacent. You know? Okay. Yeah, yeah. I had a lot of emo friends. I was more Franz Ferdinand. They were more My Chemical Romance. But we would hang around in areas of the park in which we would uniformly get bullied by cooler kids. So, you know, I've got no problem with the emos.
What do you think about Youngblood taking a run at a seat as an MP?
Look, on a like more serious note, I think it's really cool that he has said that he's interested in politics. You know, we're looking at a problem of total disillusionment around politics with younger audiences. And so for someone from that crop of the young people, God, I'm really sounding so ancient, but you know.
What's happened? You've had a baby and you've aged about 15 years in a month.
I know. Like to have someone from that demographic saying like, look, you know, politics still has a power. I can see how it could be something that I would want to dedicate my life to. I think is genuinely really, really powerful. And I would love to see him actually do it, like get involved. I'd be very curious to know what party he would run in. You know, he's progressive. We know that. Would it be Labour? I can't really see it right now. Maybe it would be the Greens. Maybe, you know, Zach Polanski and Adrian Ramsey and Ellie Chowns. They need to watch out because maybe young blood is on the come up.
It has been a successful route, particularly for the US Conservatives to get celebrities in, Reagan, Trump. I don't have a concern particularly about young blood involving himself in politics. I think that's absolutely fine. I just think that there is always a danger of patronising young people. And actually, the most important thing in terms of reaching out and engaging young people in politics is actually addressing policies that concern them directly. You know, we know what concerns young people. It's housing, it's employment opportunities, it's the environment. These are the policies that are going to engage and animate a younger generation and involve them in politics. I think that, you know, another week where all we've talked about in this country is immigration, which is not particularly an issue that animates the majority of younger voters, whilst the country continues to kind of slide into seemingly permanent economic decline and opportunities for young people decrease by the day. This has not been a good week for involving young people in politics. I think we're now on the 750th consecutive week of this not being a good week for young people in politics.
Absolutely.
I'm all for pop stars running, but just we also need policies that actually speak to a younger electorate.
Right. I get why there is a skepticism of celebrities entering politics. I mean, look at Donald Trump, right? Like this is the worst case scenario of a celebrity entering politics. But just because that's happening on the right doesn't mean that if it was done on the left, that it would necessarily follow the same tack. And I think it's also worth saying that like we've had a number of politicians on this show talk about how hard it is to be a politician. Like if you want diverse voices, different voices, progressive voices to come up into politics, you know, at the moment, the political roots they're not there for those voices to come up. And also the life of those politicians is, you know, they face enormous amounts of abuse, particularly if they're from, you know, marginalized communities. So why not cherry pick someone from a different field? Youngblood, I reckon he's got those transferable skills. You know, he's passionate, he's compelling, he's, you know, going against the grain. He's also an emo. That's not related, but I think it bears repeating that he is an emo. So, yeah, I think it's really exciting. I just hope he does it now.
Coco is definitely an emo.
So now we just wanted to end on a bit of a shout out for some grassroots football teams trying to make a difference. So recently, following the Supreme Court ruling on gender, the Football Association made the unfortunate decision to ban transgender women from competing in women's football in England.
Gold Diggers, a Hackney-based women's football team which includes trans, non-binary and gender non-conforming players, had this to say in response. We will always be a trans-inclusive club. Trans women are women. Hate won't win. Solidarity and love to all our trans teammates, friends and siblings.
And they've gone further. So inspired by designer Connor Ives's Protect the Dolls t-shirt, they've teamed up with fellow team Baller FC to release a Let the Dolls Play t-shirt with all the proceeds going to the Good Laws Project. They're challenging the Supreme Court decision.
There is a small disclaimer here. Our producer May is one of the members of Gold Diggers. So we declare an interest.
Yes.
But well done to May and the team. That is really, it's a really, really lovely thing that they're doing.
And if you want the t-shirt, you will find the link in our show notes. Speaking of show notes, by the way, you'll also find a link to one of Nish's shows.
Yes, I'm filming my tour show, Nish Don't Kill My Vibe, at the Hackney Empire on the 24th of May. This is the last time I'll do the show in London. We've released the last remaining tickets. There is a show at 5 p.m. and a show at 8:30 p.m.
Very exciting.
I'm a consummate self-promoter.
Yeah, you...
That's the thing about me. For people watching the podcast on YouTube, you will actually be able to see me frantically Googling my name and Hackney Empire.
Do you know what? I'm sure I've told you before, but I love the name of your tour. I'm sure I've told you that. But like every time you say it, I love it. I love it because I've seen the show and it's definitely not a vibe killer. It's amazing. It's like laugh out loud funny, obviously, as we would expect, but also genuinely inspiring.
Thanks, Coco.
God, this was earnest. You can tell I've been locked away in prison, isn't it? I'm coming out in my like this moment of just telling all my beloved ones, like, I think you're really great. I just want you to know. I just want you to know. And they're all like, it's only been 4 weeks, mate. Like, got to simmer down.
More evidence that Coco Khan is an emo Khan.
Anyway, that's it. Thanks for listening to Pod Save the UK.
Don't forget to follow at Pod Save the UK on Instagram, TikTok and Twitter. And we're on Blue Sky at podsavetheuk.crooked.com. And if you want more of us, and we know you do, make sure you're subscribed to our YouTube channel.
Pod Save the UK is a reduced listening production for Crooked Media.
Thanks to senior producer James Tyndale and producer May Robson.
Our theme music is by Vasilis Fotopoulos.
The executive producers are Anishka Sharma and Katie Long, with additional support from Ari Schwartz.
And remember to hit subscribe for new shows on Thursdays on Amazon, Spotify or Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts.